We are two 100% Norwegian Lutheran farm girls who didn't turn and who didn't dance and who memorized all of Luther's small catechism. It wasn't so small then. This is most certainly true.
That's Suzanne Nelson and Janice Letnes Martin. We'll be hearing from them today on Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg. On last week's show, we celebrated the high summer in northern Minnesota, but summer is just too wide to fit inside 1 hour. Today, county fairs, farmers markets, wild grapes, and Terry O'Brien discovers the boundaries of her garden. Stay tuned. I was at our county fair last week, and I realized that, unlike a lot of the kids around me, I didn't grow up going to a rural county fair, and I wondered what would that be like. So I got a hold of Suzanne Nelson and Janet Letnes Martin. They were very busy this week with the premiere of the 11th play based on the Church Basement Ladies books that they've co-authored. Their newest one, You Smell Barn, begins its extended run at the Ames Center Theater in Burnsville, Minnesota, next month. I asked Suzanne and Janet what they remember about their childhood county fairs.
For a Lutheran girl growing up on the prairie, let me tell you that was fun because we got to do all sorts of things that bordered on sin, like playing bingo. Our parents were busy eating and looking in the barn, so the kids, we'd sneak off and play bingo and try to win a prize. And then we would go and then we would throw little hoops over pop bottles to see could win something,
right,
like teddy bears or a kiwi doll on a stick. And then we never got to go to restaurants with kids, but of course we could go get hot dogs and cotton candy and things like that. And then we'd go on the rides like a tilt-a-whirl. So this was just big time fun for us. We were always so intrigued by those carnival people because they looked like scary people. We'd see these men running the rides and they'd have like Lucky Strike cigarettes hanging out of their mouth and rotted out little teeth. And they'd
silk shirts unbuttoned down to here. I'd never seen hair on a man's chest before.
And then the women would serve, you know, they would serve at the church lunch counters, the hot beef dinners with mashed potatoes. I think it was a dollar, wasn't it?
75 cents.
Yeah, clover leaf buns and pie was extra. But it was kind of a fundraiser, but it was kind of touchy for them too because they saw all these people that were heathens and they didn't know that they called heathens and they didn't know that if they really should be there. But then they kind of thought, well, maybe it's a mission field. Maybe they can get some people and talk to them about the Bible and stuff, but nobody ever did. But then they kind of looked over, and here the Catholics were serving beer right at their counter.
Right across the aisle there.
Yeah, the Catholics, spaghetti sauce running down their shirts. And it was both churches fundraising for their communities for their youth group or whatever, but it was kind of iffy sometimes if they should be there, because there was just a lot of sin and degradation there, we were told.
Yeah.
But if they could use it as a mission field, then it would be okay.
But the mission field was right there. And the fair for me was the Douglas County Fair in Alexandria. And it was mainly filled with warnings. Stay away from the carnies. Well, I didn't know what a carny was, so I stayed away from almost everything. My favorite thing about the county fair was going to the DNR fisheries building. And I pretended I was at our local lake, and I kind of learned something. I went on rides, and I would always have cotton candy and snow cones. That was a big deal for me. But yeah, it was a tilt-a-whirl for me too, and then the Ferris wheel.
Yep.
And then when I was older, like high school, I got to go on the bullet. And that was, you know, the most fun I'd had in my life until I got to be about 45 and things changed.
Every year when summer comes around, you stretch a banner across a main street in town. You can feel something happening in the air. Well, from Carol's house up on Telegraph Hill, you can see the lights going up out in the soldiers' field, getting ready for the county fair. County fair, county fair. Everybody in town will be there, so come on. Here we're going down there. Little girl with long blonde hair. Come when your daddy, one of them stuffed bears, maybe down at the county fair. Now you'll be hanging tight when we hit the top, and that roller coaster's ready to drop and break. Now you wasn't even scared. Well, baby, you know I just love the sound of that organ on the merry ground. Keep it down at the county fair, county fair, county fair. Everybody in town will be there, so come on. We're going down there. Stream of cars, so we sit a while in my front yard with her. playing soft and low. Apple car close to my heart. I lean back and stare up at the stars. Oh, I wish never have to let this moment go.
Last week, Thursday, was Kids Day at the Itasca County Fair, but it looked a lot like Friday, Senior Citizens Day. There were about as many grandparents there with batches of kids. That's one thing about a county fair. It's so age-appropriate, no matter what your age, oldsters to toddlers, young lovers who see only each other against a whirling background. And the teenagers, of course, free at last, thinking it's all there for them, everything. Twice now, a generation apart, I've had to carry out a 3-year-old in full meltdown, kicking and screaming because we grown-ups said it was time to leave the fair. Way too much fun. When my youngest grandchild was 3, she followed her 4-year-old brother through the gate as I followed her into each ride and then bailed out each time he climbed into the contraption, had to be rescued, safely carried to the other side of the fence before the ride could start. 3 times we tried the little boat, the little airplane, the little car, and 3 times she panicked, arms pinwheeling her away. But then we came to the train, the car reassuringly on the track and attached to the ones in front and behind. Very tentatively, she climbed in all on her own this time, not with her brother. A look of intense concentration as the locomotive started to pull her along, and before the little train was halfway around its track, her face lit up, triumphant, head held high, just thrilled. I can see that moment clear as anything. This year, of course, was a whole different proposition for her. She's 5 and fearless. I don't mean to brag, but she did pretty good at the beanbag toss, too. I did see more than one little kid realize too late that this ride was not for him, crying into Daddy's chest, who wondered if there was some way he could get the guy to stop this thing. But the kids I really admire at the fair are the ones displaying their ducklings, rabbits, goats, ponies, puppies, pigs, alpacas. I like watching these kids being so watchful of their charges, of course, but just as much of the crowds, more strangers at one time than they see anywhere else. They watch how the people act and how much the people don't think anyone's watching them. If I had gone back to the fair with a recorder, I could introduce you to some of these patient stewards and their prize winners. Even the shyest of them has plenty to say about Clara or Jordan or Cody, a story about which one's their favorite. They may or may not be future farmers, but they sure are present-day practitioners, expertly learning what they can do and what they need to do. You're tuned to Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg. We don't have any Blue Ribbon winners from this year's County Fair on today's show, but we do have Charlie Parson. He told me recently about the matriarch of the household his family lived with when he was a boy.
Every morning we had biscuits. And this is kind of an East Tennessee thing, but biscuits every morning. And she proceeded to do that for 24 years until her youngest son was out of college. I think the last 3 years she figured out that she could par bake the biscuits and then let George, who was the youngest, finish the biscuits when he got up. And so she didn't actually have to be there because she taught school full time too. But when the boys turned 13, there must have been an age separation there in the 4-H, you could enter baking. And each of the boys in turn entered biscuit baking. And each of the boys in turn beat all the girls in Washington County, Tennessee at biscuit baking and got the blue ribbon or the purple ribbon for exceptional. And I moved out of Tennessee when I was 12. But having been a guest in the household there, you know, biscuits meant a lot to me, too. And I never did anything about that through college, graduate school, et cetera. But when I came to Bemidji, here was the Beltrami County Fair. And I thought, wow, I could enter biscuits in the fair and get my lifelong passion kind of out of the way, sort of achieve something, for God's sakes. And so I did. I baked biscuits, and I entered them in the fair, and they put me in men's baking. Well, there aren't a whole lot of men bakers here. So there was one other kind of pathetic plate of biscuits, and I got a blue ribbon, but I didn't feel very accomplished. And so I went and talked to the county agent and asked what I could do to compete against the women. And she just said, well, you just entered it in open class, and you're not, you know, that way. And I even went so far as to bake a batch and take it into the extension office and have them critique them and tell me, what do you judge biscuits on? And they talked to me about that. And so then when the fair came, I baked biscuits and I put them in. And by golly, I got a blue ribbon in biscuits against all the women in Beltrami County, which is nowhere near as great an accomplishment as beating all the women in Washington County, Tennessee. But I felt good about it. And I thought I had this down. Then we went on a trip. I got divorced. I remarried. I married Jill. Jill's a love. And she decided, and I agreed, that we ought to take my mom, who by then was 75 years old, down to visit the cousins in Alabama, whom I had hardly met, even though I was named after one. I was named after Charlie Smith, who was a very interesting character. He nearly cut his right foot off, splitting wood, and then he nearly cut his left foot off, showing his neighbor how he did it. And that's my namesake, so my targets are kind of low as far as I have to do to achieve my name, but he also was very shrewd. Anyway, he went to visit these people, the Smiths, in Union Springs, Alabama, and got up in the morning, and here, my cousin, who we called Aunt because she's so much older than we, was making biscuits. And I thought I knew about biscuits, but she pulled her biscuits out of the oven, and they're on cast iron griddles. And it absolutely revolutionized my biscuit making. And so now in my kitchen, I have two cast iron griddles because sometimes a dozen biscuits isn't enough.
Thanks to Charlie Parson for that. Maybe I can get over to his house some breakfast hour.
Some assistance. Fun is free. Get dizzy with me. Don't put up no resistance.
That's a group called Tape 5. And here's some old friends, Bill Hinckley and Judy Larson.
1, 2, you know what to do.
Vegetables put on a spree every week down at the farmer's market. That's where I ran into Harry Hutchins. He's the co-host with John Latimer of A Walk on the Wild Side every Tuesday morning here on Northern Community Radio. He was at the farmer's market just having a great time, and he told me about an experiment that he conducted. Could he find there everything that he needs?
Well, I just wanted to see for myself if I could have a whole month of trying to eat good food and see if the farmer's market offered everything that I would need. And it was been pretty amazing to me to see that that's, I have no problem finding all the food. There's, except for one thing, that's cheese. And, you know, I find that I have a lot of cheese and the occasional snack like popcorn and pretzels. But I talked to one of the vendors and she started making pretzels for me so and offering it that with their bread. So now I have just about everything I need. And I have to say, Michael, there's one thing I miss, dark chocolate. So, but you know, you don't grow chocolate here in Minnesota. No cocoa. So anyways, that's the, but essentially, you know, the tomatoes came in early. People are growing them in their hoop houses. And the, you know, everything else, the jams and the jellies and the breads, it's just amazing to me that there's nothing that I get from the grocery store that I can't get here grown by one somebody local. And I look over down the road and there's even a bottle or two of wine. That shows you the diversity here. The other thing is, as I didn't know I was going to see you here today, but that's it. You see everybody here that you know, and it's a good time to gather together and talk with people and see how they're doing. And this is my social scene. So I get that social part. I can go right down the row here and get a pizza. And you know, all the sweets that you can imagine are here, cooked with local blueberries and all that stuff. So it's pretty cool.
Thanks to Harry Hutchins for that. His idea to make a complete diet, including locally made wines, out of the foods at the farmer's market reminded me of wild foods expert Gil Qual of Deer River. He and his wife, Jean, lived pretty much on what they could gather 7 months of the year, the wild harvests. Gil taught generations of folks in northern Minnesota to find, gather, and make delicious use of the natural foods that grow all around us. And he shared his knowledge with Northern Community Radio listeners. It wasn't only the foods that he collected. He collected stories, too.
One can gather vignettes as well as grapes from the vine. Once, while vainly trying to grasp a lofty cluster, I was shaken to my bootstraps by a raucous caw overhead, so close and so loud, it seemed that the bird on the canopy above had no knowledge of the human below. Was he feeding on grapes? I wondered, but never found out, for unseen by me he flew to parts unknown. He left unsighted, but the imagery remained, a strange, unnatural scenario, shrouded by a vividness that begged for an explanation. Months later it dawned on me. Vignettes, like vintage, must bide their time. They must ferment within the watersheds of each private conscience until they mature. With me, the setting mood and voice from above made the moment indelible. There was no lesson to be learned, no moral imparted, just an imprint etched in my consciousness that will always color my grape gathering. To me, the Aesopian ambience of that moment is as memorable as any draught of any wild brew concocted by man or nature. Grapes make an excellent juice and a superb jelly. They make a fine wine, and some will claim that there's none better. Whatever its merits, there's one sobering thought to be retained in your mind. You will never know unless you search out the cloistered covert of the wild grape.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewy, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me. Champagne me, show me you love me, kid love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Peace.
be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crib, cut me a rope. Show me you love me, kid, love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Luxury's lap, hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't bug me, new thunder burn me. You heard me, I'm getting hungry. Peel me a here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't bug me, new thunder burden me. You heard me, I am getting hungry. Grape.
Well, that's Diane Krall. She just kills me. You're tuned to Stay Human on KAXE KBXE. If you're a contributing member of this community radio service, thank you for keeping us on the air. This and other local programs also receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, thanks to the Minnesota voters who passed the Legacy Amendment to our state constitution. On today's show, we're featuring stories about the abundance of summer at the county fair, the farmers' markets, and, of course, in the gardens. Longtime gardener Terry O'Brien is a frequent contributor to our program, and she stopped by the studios last week to tell us about something she learned in the garden.
Spring, summer, and fall. I'm the woman at the checkout counter who looks like she just blew in from the back 40. Uncombed, windblown hair dragged into some kind of makeshift bun, dirt-smudged knees and ragged nails. When handing over the change, the cashier flinches at the rasp of my roughened hands, takes one look at my fingertips, stained a hue on the spectrum from yellowish-green to greeny-brown, and pegs me for a smoker with a really bad habit. I could explain. I was tying up the tomatoes, or pinching back the basil, or some other chore that required me to get down in the dirt. But that would hold up the line, and I don't feel the need to make excuses for growing my own food and a few perennials. Fact is, I love the feel of good soil between my fingers. Soil under the fingernails comes with a job. Gardening has taught me many things, from when to side-dress sweet corn to not being squeamish about squishing slugs or the larva of potato beetles with my bare hands. Caution, the latter produces a repulsive smear of orange goo. But sometimes we gardeners are like the proverbial ostrich with our heads, if not in the sand, close to it. For some tasks, like planting small seeds and micro-weeding, require a myopic view. It took the observations of some international visitors to one of my previous gardens to expand my perspective, my worldview even, on the idea of a garden. Two East German young adults came to visit in late spring, a few years before the Berlin Wall fell, when the rhubarb was up. They stayed for 2 weeks. Meals were often crowned with a big pan of rhubarb crunch straight from the garden via a churn in the oven. The guys relished this crispy oatmeal, butter, and brown sugar-topped confection of rhubarber, as they knew it at home. One Sunday, the East German suggested that we take our breakfast out in the garden. I was perplexed by this request. We had several gardens in our front yard where the rhubarb, the raspberries, and the vegetables were grown. Now, some were raised beds, others fenced, more flower beds situated on the side of the house, and two long perennial beds framed the lawn. Actually, sitting in any one of those gardens to take their coffee and rhubarber crunch seemed to me problematic, if not impractical. How they laughed! Had I really thought they meant to straddle the hills of emerging string beans or squeeze their lawn chairs in between the rows of peas? Well, to me, the grassy areas, that was the yard. The places where the flowers and vegetables grew, that was the garden. In their unified view, the lawn, sometimes a bowling green for bocce ball, the picnic table, the Whitney and Centennial crab apples, the low area that would flood in the spring, the flower and herb beds, the entire yard was a garden. By comparison, my demarcated idea of a garden was narrowly defined, as compartmentalized as Germany divided after World War II, where East and West Berliners customarily sat in their gardens on a Sunday morning and read the newspaper. My definition of a garden was further expanded by a bright immigrant artist from Cameroon who came to study studio arts at Bemidji State University. He saw our garden for the first time in late summer, when heavy, purple-black eggplants hung low and shiny from their spiny stems. Shinya! I think that's how he pronounced eggplant in the language of his village where his father was chief. "Teddy," he said in his accented but well-spoken English, taking in the voluptuous view of a productive garden in high summer, "this is a farm." The expanse of our front yard, with space to throw a frisbee or a baseball, the flowers that nourished bees, butterflies, and birds, and its vegetable beds teeming with the harvest. It was the size of his grandmother's farm back home in Cameroon, Africa. Our garden, a farm. Surely his grandmother bought or traded for some commodities. But the reality that in some places of the world, a person's livelihood depends on the output of a farm the size of my front yard challenged my ideas about land use, food production, solutions to hunger, and the choices we make in our own neighborhoods and communities. What if townships, municipalities, forbade expansive lawns that require extensive mowing and reliance on petroleum, water, and chemicals? Instead, some of that effort would go into plantings of food crops. There'd be free corn boils in every neighborhood, parties when the potatoes need digging, classes to teach food preservation. No person would go hungry or suffer from poor nutrition. Then one summer, in a different garden, a public garden, where I was the chief volunteer garden goddess, another visitor helped me see that my garden was connected to the entire universe, to the cycle of life, death, and rebirth. All May, June, and July that season, I had labored in the garden, digging it by hand, planning, planting, manuring, watering, weeding, preparing it for its one big showing, the first weekend in August. After work, I'd drive to the site, get a few hours in before dark. Sometimes one of my dearest friends dropped by on his way home from picking berries or some other wild foods harvest, and he'd help me tie up the Jacob's cattle beans or with whatever chore that went easier with four hands. While we worked, he gently chided me about neglecting what he called my wild self, the part of me that needs to be outdoors engaging with nature. "But I do that," I countered, "in the garden." "Not the same," he retorted, and I knew he was right. We'd make a plan to go ricing or to look for berries or mushrooms. On the Friday of the big event that year, when the garden would be on display for visitors and he would guide nature walks, my dear friend returned to his home after picking raspberries, sat down, had a heart attack, died. I heard later that evening, how would I be able to meet the public all Saturday and Sunday, tour the garden, talk about heritage gardening? "I'll keep my head down," I told myself. "There's always more weeds that need pulling. I'll turn my backside to the public, and I won't encourage conversation." And that's what I did. Most people passed by without a glance. Some paused and complimented the traditional symmetrical arrangement of beds and their bounty. One woman stepped directly into the middle of the garden and demanded my attention. She was a healer, she said, and like so many healers, appeared to have some ailment that was beyond her capability. I wasn't sure that she had complete vision. She spoke about the healing properties of plants, something that my departed friend, while not an expert in that field, was certainly conversant on the subject. Distracted by my loss, I didn't listen closely. But at one point, with a lift of her hand, the woman said something like, "The whole world is a garden." In that gesture, my eyes lifted over the tall palisade wall that enclosed the garden and the historic buildings, and traveled to the treetops beyond, to the tamarack with its fuchsia-colored cones in spring, to the wild blueberries that edged the clearing beyond, to the nature trail laid out by my friend and interpreted by him in three languages. Despite the wall that protected it from marauding deer, the lift of the healer's hand conjoined my garden with the wild world, this green earth. My grief was for the time stabbed, even knowing that soon my friend's ashes would be spread upon the earth. If you put in a few petunias, or plant a row of carrots, and you take care of them, you learn about plants' needs, the soil, insects, even things about yourself. In the garden of the world, in the seeds that ripen in fall and sprout in spring, I am reminded life will go on, followed by death, of course, then, miraculously, life again.
Yo-Yo Ma performing Johann Sebastian Bach. We've also had room in this hour for Bruce Springsteen, Bill and Judy, Tape 5. There's so much great music, such an abundance of talent for us. It's my privilege to present Stay Human each week, featuring a few of the talented storytellers and essayists in our region. This week, Terry O'Brien, Charlie Parson, Harry Hutchins, Gil Quall, and Suzanne Nelson and Janet Letness Martin. And that's just the human abundance. The wild berries and wild foods, the kids with their animals at the county fair, the growers and eaters together at the farmer's market, all the gardeners busy preserving summer's gifts. It is a garden we live in, isn't it, the world? We were taught that once the world was a garden, but humans were banished into the wilderness. Because of you, cursed is the ground, according to that old story. Toil and pain, men over women, and humans over everything in creation. I'm pretty sure that even hearing this story as a young child, I knew it didn't add up. I mean, wait, the only human at first was male, so were there no females of any animals, or what? And why put that tree right in the middle with a big keep off sign unless you wanted to make sure the fruit would be eaten? I'd like to think it's just an old story. Can't do us any harm anymore, right? But these old stories go deep, some of them, and stories are all we've got for making sense of the world. I just finished reading a brilliant new novel, Overstory, by Richard Powers. It's about the forest of the world, about life on Earth and what it wants of us humans. It's a much more useful story than the old one about Adam and Eve. I hope it's not too late for us to learn it. The novel revolves around a group of people whose choices move the plot along, but the most important characters are the trees, a chestnut, a grove of beeches, a maple, an ancient redwood. One of the humans in the book, a botanist, thinks this: people aren't the apex species they think they are. Other creatures, bigger, smaller, slower, faster, older, younger, more powerful, other creatures call the shots, make the air, and eat sunlight. Without them, nothing. Overstory by Richard Powers. It made me think, what if we quit telling stories derived from the one about the Garden of Eden? What if our actions were governed because we realized that the ground isn't cursed, the wilderness not our enemy? What stories could we tell, I wonder, if we stop pretending to be what we're not? Stay human and stay tuned. Thank you.
with a satisfied mind. Once I was winning, and fortune and fame, everything that I dreamed for, to get a start in life's game.